It's that special time of the year, folks. Happy holidays. Elsie and I are here to bring you our holiday extravaganza Q&A session. And without further ado, Elsie, welcome.
Thank you. I'm excited about this. Like we did last year, we asked our listeners to chime in with some questions, send us a voicemail. We actually got 6 questions.
Robust response this year. Exactly. Very robust.
People want the swag, I think.
I think that helps. So maybe let's kick things off with an icebreaker because that's what we love to do. Elsie, when you were in graduate school, were there any like holiday traditions that you would partake in?
Yeah, I would say that like we always had kind of a year-end group meeting around the holidays where Keith would bring in like chocolate or holiday candy, canes and whatever. And we would have a problem set and it was like you had like these, you know, these like blackboards that you can roll around in a room.
Yeah.
And they were two-sided, so there's teams on both sides. And then they would like, you'd have to race and like see who gets to the problem the fastest and then you'd win candy.
Oh, that's intense.
Yeah, it was fun. But it also was very stressful for the more junior graduate students who were like,
yeah,
everybody wanted to win.
They wanted the candy canes.
Exactly. At the end, there was plenty for everyone to just have anyway. So it's not like.
Yeah, but it's the pride.
Exactly.
You wanted to earn that candy cane.
But that's probably the only holiday thing that I remember. And we were off. Like the university closed essentially between Christmas and New Year's. So there's not a lot of people that would, you know, come into the lab anyways. So it's just a time to be with family and.
Yeah.
And just sort of take a break. How about you?
Same thing. In the Wolf Lab, we, you know, basically took off. I would say there weren't any holiday traditions unique to the Wolf Lab, but I would say that my husband and I, who's also a graduate student at Michigan, it was always the journey to Wisconsin to see family that was the most memorable. And so snowstorms that would close the interstate. And then, visiting my dad in northern Wisconsin, where one year we wanted to have real ice from the lake. And so we brought a chainsaw to the lake and cut out slabs of ice.
Like frozen.
Frozen to make. Yeah, it was insane. It was insane. My dad and Jameson reached a new level of friendship at that.
That's pretty cool, actually.
So
that's awesome. That's great. All right, should we dive into our first question?
Let's get it.
All right, so actually, our first question was sent to us via voicemail. So I'm just going to play the voicemail here, and then I'll toss it over to you for the first response. So here we go.
Hi, Elsie and Danny. This is Bill Motch. Right now, I'm a fourth-year graduate student at Temple University in the Wengernick Lab. My question is, as someone who is about to start looking for jobs, what is a good way to figure out if I would be a better fit in a medicinal chemistry group or a process chemistry group? What sort of resources are there that are out there to sort of help graduate students figure out what roles in industry would be a good fit for them? Thank you so much.
Thanks, Bill. Great question. I would say there's a lot of resources that are available to you. One that kind of comes to mind is that when you are attending conferences, whether that be an ACS or a NOS or a Gordon, they typically have lineups of medicinal chemists and also process chemistry speakers. So those are really good opportunities for you to kind of sit in and kind of hear the stories that those folks are telling and see what kind of interests you more. I would say another avenue that might be a little bit more hands-on is most, I'd say, pharmaceutical companies have a pretty robust internship program. And this goes back to, being an undergraduate or even even a graduate. So I would say that those are probably two good ways for you to get more exposure to what both of those fields are like. But Elsie, what would you say would be a good way to approach it?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is an opportunity to both build and leverage your network or the network of your peers or of your PI. Ask people what their day-to-day job is like and what they spend their time on. Try to get a diversity of folks across companies, because being a process chemist at one company is not going to be the same as being a process chemist somewhere else. And that's true in the med chem space as well. And then I would also ask or try to find a collection of people that can comment on sort of what career progression looks like, because your job on day one probably look pretty different than your job 10 years later. And understanding sort of what the regular progression looks like and how the role changes and where you spend your time, I think will give you a pretty good idea of what that's like. I always tell students when they ask me about this that, you know, you ultimately become the people that you work with. And so if you meet a lot of people that work in these industries, in these disciplines and in these companies, you'll have a sense of what they're like. And if you imagine yourself becoming like they are, then that's probably a pretty good sign that it's a good fit.
Good answer. Okay, moving on. Mike Axiotes? I probably really butchered that. What do we feel?
Yeah, I have no idea.
Okay, moving on to the question. Sorry, Mike. What do you know that you wished you knew during your undergraduate or early graduate school? Elsie, would you like to start and maybe I'll chime in?
I mean, if I think personally, I don't know that there's really anything that I learned when I first joined the pharmaceutical industry that I was like, oh, I can't believe I didn't learn that. You know, there were things obviously that I learned, and there's a pretty steep learning curve when you come into this, but a lot of that has to do with the interdisciplinary nature of the work. And then, you know, sort of what matters changes depending on whether you're in the medicinal chemistry space, process chemistry space. You know, one of the things that I think was really beneficial to me in retrospect, not that it was deliberate, is that I did an undergraduate degree in biopharmaceutical sciences that had a lot of biochemistry and biology and even physiology in it. And that turns out to be pretty helpful when we're talking about the interface of sort of, you know, the drugs that we developed and the therapeutic areas that they're in. And I have an appreciation for some of these fields without being an expert. And that's probably something that a lot of people who do chemistry degrees don't really get a chance to experience. But I can't say there's anything that I was like, oh, I really should have learned that. What about you?
I agree. I also had a background in biology, cell biology. So that kind of helped me understand more of the discovery chemistry space. But I would say something that I wish I did more in graduate school was read the literature more. And this is something that I think is universal to whether you are an undergraduate, a graduate, or even a current industrial chemist. I think the literature is something that is really valuable to keep up to speed on, because you never know when you're going to find something that is going to help the problem that you're working on today. And so I would say find a way to somehow read more, because it does matter. And it's something that I've definitely stepped up when I entered my career here at Merck.
Yeah. And sometimes you see things that can help your colleagues, which is also
absolutely
great,
and then you're
way
a
to make
hero.
Friends.
Yeah. You're like, did you see this? Or then you're like, did you see this? And you're like, oh my God, I'm scooped. So
it goes both ways.
It goes both ways. But I use Google Scholar. Like, I have Google Scholar alerts for a bunch of different things.
I used to use Google Reader, which was so good to, like, just look at
don't
abstracts.
Don't get me started.
Yeah, I'm very sad that that's gone. Yeah. That was a superior product.
Yeah.
All right. Let's move on to the next question from Eleanor, who asks, how is pregnancy and parenthood handled in industry? Follow-up, safety of the fetus, time away from the bench, mat and pat leave, childcare, et cetera. So a pretty comprehensive question here. And actually, there's quite a bit to talk about here. So Danny, why don't you kick us off a little bit?
Yeah, sure thing. So I think where we'll start is, one, congratulations if you come into our space and you are expecting a baby. This is a really exciting time, and we're definitely excited to help you take on this next milestone of your life. And so I think for first places to start is with the mother. And so I would say that, of course, safety is paramount here. And so we have a health services group here that can advise the mother on, the activities that they want to partake in, whether that be lab-based or not. Most of the time, mothers don't want to be in the lab, and that makes total sense. But in the instance that they do, we definitely have a variety of different options for them within that space. As far as non-lab-based roles, I would say that you can take on more, hands-on scientific roles that are not lab-based. But there's also leadership roles that kind of give you the opportunity to oversee strategy or to guide the direction of a of a scientific team where you're overseeing chemistry indirectly that means. So, Elsie, have you had, I think you've had experience with this over your time.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the ways that I sometimes relay what this looks like, it's not all that different than if you injure yourself and you can't mm-hmm. be in the lab, right? So I had this experience myself. I broke my arm while playing hockey and I couldn't actually safely operate in the lab. And so I was out of the lab for about 6 months and worked with my manager to kind of figure out what was the best use of my time during that. And so I think those are the kinds of assignments that we try to align people's interests, people's career aspirations. It's a great time to learn new things, right? Because you can create time for that, but then also play to people's strengths, right? So for me, I sat on a strategic initiative team and it was a great opportunity for me to network with people that I probably wouldn't have met if I wouldn't have sat on that team. And then I got to revamp one of our business processes for interfacing with our external partners. And that's still used today, like 10 years later, right? So I actually think that the best way to make the most of this time when you have to be out of the lab for whatever reason is to really have those productive conversations with folks and figure out sort of what's the best way that you can leverage your talents to have the maximum impact. Of course, at some point, the child arrives.
Yep.
And that's another fantastic time for the family, but that usually is coupled with leave. And so Merck actually has a really nice leave policy these days. So parental leave, so both mothers and fathers are able to get 12 weeks of fully paid parental leave in the U.S. Of course, this is country-specific guidance, so we'll limit our discussions to the U.S. here. And that's a really nice policy. I can say that it hasn't always been that way. And when I first moved to the U.S. and when my son was born, fathers only got 5 days, right? So that's not a lot of time to spend with a newborn. It's not a lot of time to support your family when you're trying to just figure it out, especially if it's your first kid. And by the time my daughter was born almost 6 years ago, that policy had gotten to 6 weeks. And now here we are at 12 weeks. So that parental leave is in addition to any sort of short-term disability benefits that birthing mothers are eligible for based on those requirements as well. So it's really a great way for people to be able to spend time with their newborn, but also you can take that leave whichever way you want in the first year of life of the child. And so a lot of people will spread that out or take it in chunks. It really depends on sort of what works for your family and what works for both parents.
Yep. And so then once the baby arrives and your leave is done, the return to work is the next, is definitely the next step. And so at our company, we do have on-site childcare that a lot of folks use, and it's a really very convenient resource. But also, as far as your actual return to work, if you are the mother, you may not want to go into the lab right away again, and that's totally fine. And so again, aligning those assignments to make sure that you're comfortable in the situation that you're in and that you're set up for success is of paramount importance for us. And I would say, take it easy. Like, there's no rush. This is a marathon. I know some people come back and they want to hit the ground running as fast as they can and make up for that lost time. But, we try to just exercise that, we're here to support you. And we just want to make sure that we're doing all that we can to get you to where you want to be.
Yeah. And we should add that there's also opportunities for sabbaticals or unpaid leave beyond the 12 weeks. So we have a lot of parents who decide to take a little bit of extra time and they can still come back to their position when they do so. And so the idea here is to set people up for success, right? If you look at the data on this, a significant portion of mothers and even a significant portion of fathers leave STEM jobs after they have children. That's really a loss for us in terms of all the talent that, would otherwise not be available to help us do the really important things that we do. So we try to support people through that. And having gone through it myself 3 times as a father, once in Canada and then twice in the U.S., yeah, I was really happy to have the support of my management and sort of the support of the company to be able to do that.
Thanks, Eleanor, for the great question. Moving on, Anne McNeil. How do you decide with whom you collaborate with in academia? And when do you decide versus doing it in-house versus doing it externally?
So I can maybe start. I think collaboration across industrial academia access is really important, and that can span a wide range of things depending on the group, the problem at hand. I would say at Merck Chemistry, let's use that sort of narrower scope. Most of the external collaborations are actually catalyzed by the people involved, right? So there's a scientist inside of Merck that has some interesting piece of science, or maybe they just have an interest in something and they meet someone on the outside, or maybe it's someone in their broader network, and they ultimately decide that they want to work together on that problem and sort of have an impact. Most of the time, that interest is something that is well outside of sort of the intellectual property boundaries that we have. And the goal is really just to advance the field. And so, you know, for the second part of the question where it's like, when do you decide to do it alone versus in-house? I would say there are things we do alone because it's important that, you know, we own those things. And we have obviously phenomenal capabilities. But there will be times when you're just trying to move the puck forward a little bit and make an impact. And certainly the collaborations I've been a part of have mostly been this way.
Yep.
What about you, Danny?
I would say the same. Most of the collaborations that I've been part of are through my network, and they were not on anything of IP consideration, so total freedom to operate and to publish. But they were really opportunities to support women, actually, in chemistry and their students. And so my first collaboration was with Cammie Hull, and that was a really fantastic opportunity to bring in a graduate student, Jenny Kennemore, who is now a postdoc at Caltech with Francis Arnold. Go, Jenny. And she came into Merck. She used our high throughput experimentation resources. We did some asymmetric catalysis, found a ligand that gave us high EE. And it really was a great experience for myself to mentor someone. I was very early in my career. And also for her to kind of get a behind the scenes look at how we operate within this space. I would say, I think it's truly a partnership when you engage with an academic partner, not just a toss a problem over the fence and hope that they figure it out and the communication is very spotty. I would say that when this is done right, both teams are working in the same direction. They meet on a semi-regular basis. They exchange ideas. They exchange chemicals sometimes. And ultimately, you have a really beautiful collaborative paper that shows once it's ultimately published. So,
yep.
I love collabs, man. Let's keep them coming.
Yep. All right, let's keep going. Next question is from Alex. What recent breakthrough in chemistry over the last few years has been the biggest surprise? Or maybe one that you would have never even been imagined, you know, 5 or 10 years ago?
I would say photocatalysis has been something that I started off interested in probably, 2012, which is in this 5 to 10 year range, because it was just starting to take off. So you had, Dave McMillan, Teshik Yoon, Corey Stevenson, just knocking it out of the park, showing these really unbelievable transformations. And since joining Merck, I would say that the amount that I see photochemistry proposed for accessing some of the chemical matter that we would like to, and the amount of times it works and is something that we're ultimately running on scale, has been a very exciting time, I think, for the industry. So that was one that kind of came to mind for me. What about you?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like often you see a paper and it's like a really clever application of something that you kind of already knew. So it's more of like how it comes together. Mm-hmm. And I think for me, the photoredox thing was really sort of like, it changed the way I thought about making molecules, or it changed the way I thought about mechanisms, right? And that's pretty rare. I mean, another way that I think has changed the way I think about molecules has been sort of the evolution of biocatalysis. So biocatalysis has been around for a while. And I mean, one of the first projects I was ever on at Merck 15 plus years ago now, we used a transaminase. But for a very long time, biocatalysis was restricted to a relatively small number of functional group interconversion reactions. And it was really only a few classes of enzymes that were really reliably useful for us. And I think in the last 7-ish years, we've seen a dramatic increase in our ability to develop novel biocatalysts that do things like, you know, what we call biocatalytic cascades, where we can sequence, you know, three or four enzymes in a single pot to basically assemble a molecule and significantly increase the complexity that we can do. And it's really changed the way that, at least with certain bond-forming events, that we think about making molecules. And I don't know that that would have been possible at all 5 or 10 years ago, and it's the investments in protein evolution and all the biochemistry to support that, and as well as the training of all the chemists to be able to understand the chemistry in a way. Like, I feel like it's a little bit the same for photoredox. Like, the retrosynthetic disconnections need to be learned.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And I think it was kind of the same for BioCat for a while. Like, it was, okay, we've now learned that you can take a ketone and turn it into a chiral alcohol, which isn't a bit that big of a stretch. But I think starting to think about how you break apart a molecule into multiple different biocatalytic cascades is definitely something we had to learn as an organization.
Yeah. Okay, last question from Stana Dorn. If you could draw any chemical transformation on paper and have it work in the lab, what would it be and why? Good old paper chemistry.
Yeah, yeah. This question, you could ask it every quarter and you'd probably get a different answer around here. Like, this is usually heavily influenced by the problems that people have at hand. And I would say there's probably a number of them that I think could be really, really interesting. And I think part of it is also, like, what's the application, right? So, for example, when you're a medicinal chemist and you're designing new analogs, you often want to make relatively small changes on a molecule that's, you know, a decent size, and you want to do that in the least number of steps possible. The classic example of this is, like, introducing methyl groups, right? The whole magic methyl effect. And often that requires you to completely resynthesize your molecule. So these methods that can selectively introduce functional groups or SAR vectors in a late fashion on a molecule are always going to be of interest. But what that exact transformation is at any given time is probably very, very different. Whereas in the process chem space, a lot of times is you want to use these really cheap and readily available starting materials because you can get them on scale. And then you want to be able to go as fast as possible or as most direct as possible from that to whatever chemical you're interested in today. So that kind of goes all over the place. But like a classic example would be to be able to use natural amino acids and very easily and quickly turn them into non-canonical amino acids, right? So, you know, derivatives of aromatic and non-aromatic amino acids that otherwise require us to go back to sort of amino acid synthesis, right? So that's an example that certainly comes to mind for me. What about you, Danny?
I'd say one that comes to mind for me is CH fluorination with a F- source.
Yeah.
And I was on a project where we had, we wanted to make 2-fluoroadenine, very simple on paper. Ideally, you want to make that from adenine, like you said, commodity chemical, very, very cheap. Can you just take adenine and convert it to 2-fluoro? No. I did as much as I could. I use fluorine gas. I tell people that, and they're like, you have fluorine gas? Like, in a safe manner, I tried fluorine gas. It did not touch adenine. That is a rock solid nucleobase.
That's interesting.
Which makes sense. It's been around for a really long time.
It's been through a lot. Billions of years.
Billions of years. Adenine's still kicking. So,
I mean, fluorinations in general, right? If you think about the fluorinations that people use, they're usually electrophilic fluorinating reagents.
Yes.
Which are expensive, hazardous, wasteful, and it usually involves multiple steps to both prepare your substrate for that fluorination. So you got to have, you're converting something. And nucleophilic fluorine sources are definitely the cheapest ones that you can get, right? Sodium fluoride basically is what you would want to use for all this stuff. Some F-dot sources are not so bad, like NFSI, right, is probably the cheapest source of F-dot you can get. But yeah, I agree with you. There's just, this backs to linking a cheap starting material to a value-added product. Yep. I think there's definitely work to be done there.
Okay, folks. Our goodie bag of questions is empty.
Yes.
So I think we have nailed it. You'll have to let us know in the comments. And we really appreciate all of our listeners this year. 2022 was a banner year for the podcast. We had a lot of new listeners, new countries coming online. And I'd say, Elsie, it's been a real joy, and it's been a good time.
Yeah. This is a great way to close 2022. Thanks, Danny, for all the fun this year.
All the fun.
And thanks to all the listeners, and everybody have a safe holiday season, and we'll catch you in January.
Sounds good. Bye.
Bye. Dashing through the snow in a one-horse open sleigh.
Over the fields we go, laughing all the way. Bells on bobtail ring, making spirits bright. What fun it is to ride and sing a sleighing song tonight. Jingle bells, jingle bells, jingle all the way. Jingle bells, jingle bells.